So for this evening's talk, another suggestion which was in my box when I came in this afternoon from a beautiful monastery down in Serpentine was that a Buddhist member, she's getting very irritated at her partner because her partner's not Buddhist, but he's a much better Buddhist than she is. She always gets angry and he keeps on saying, come on, let go, let go, let go. And that really gets an upper wick, as they say. So she asked for a talk this evening. How can you deal with irritating people, especially the ones you live with? And of course, that's something which is close to the heart of many, many people, because it's a part of life. We cannot avoid irritating people. The first truth of Buddhism is the first noble truth. He said life is suffering. And of course, you say, oh, yeah, now I understand why. So we always tend to, it's amazing also. I mean, look, I mean, these are the people you marry. And, yeah, you've got choice. We don't have shotgun marriages anymore in this country. They're not arranged by your parents. So you chose that guy. You chose that woman. So, you know, stop complaining. The trouble is, you know, when we do choose a partner in life, we should be a bit more careful when we choose somebody. You know, just take her to the psychiatrist or the psychologist first of all, get a good assessment. That's what we do these days. You buy a car, you go to the RAC or something like that and get it, you know, checked out to see what is a really good model or not. We look in the paper, like in the Witch magazine, to say this particular model of car, whether it works very well. So, you know, you can do that with sort of with husbands as well, you know, where they come from, what age they are. And must be something in Witch magazine which gives, you know, a sort of an assessment of that particular type of model of man. But the point is that even if you do all the research, even if you're very careful, this is the nature of life, that the person you live with is irritating. You know why they're irritating? Because you're irritating too. It's our nature that when people live close together, as they say, the closer you are, the more friction there is, which means the more you rub up against each other. And sometimes that can get very irritating. But fortunately, the reason we come to places like this is all these techniques and strategies to deal with an irritating partner, an irritating boss, or an irritating cat, or whatever else you've got in your house, to actually to learn sort of how to deal with this in a positive manner, which also means that you actually learn a lot about life and about yourself. Because, okay, you may get rid of this irritating person. You may call, like, you know, the pest controller, you know, to get rid of your husband or your wife, whoever else is a pest in the house. But what happens? And another pest comes in afterwards. So that's really no solution. You've done that before. You know what that I mean, don't you? I mean, so divorce, separation, and off you go trying again. And those of you who are on your second relationship or third or fourth or fifth, come on, it's all the same, isn't it? Don't ever think that the problem is with the person you've got. No, this is the nature of life and the nature of you and the nature of the way you look at life and deal with these problems. That's the problem. It's not the person. It's not you. It's not the situation. It's just the way we deal with these situations. This is a basic teaching of Buddhism. It's nothing wrong with the world. There's nothing wrong with you. The mistake is the way we interact with life. It's not life is not wrong. You are not wrong. It's the interaction, the relationship. That is where the problem lies. So if you just change the guy, or change your house, or change your job, or whatever, that doesn't really change the problem, because it's the relationship. That is what the problem is, the attitudes. So how do we change the attitudes when someone's irritating us? Number one, accept life is irritating. We learn from this. We learn a bit of patience and tolerance to the irritating parts of life. For example, I do remember one of the early books I read on spirituality was of this teacher called Gurdjieff. He was a Russian guy who was, you know, a bit of a guru, maybe in the late 50s, I think maybe earlier than that. And he ran this ashram, this spiritual community in France, of all places. And apparently that when he died, they got all his papers together. And in his community, there was one guy, who was really a pain in the neck to everybody. You know, a fellow that no one else could really sort of get on with at all. And they'd often ask, you know, can you let this guy go? He's causing a lot of problems for everybody. It's just so irritating. And they found out that everybody else in that community had to pay, you know, rent or sort of some contribution to the food. That was the only guy who was actually paid by Gurdjieff to be there. He was an employee of the place. He was paid to be there and irritate people. And you wonder what the heck was going on. Because that sometimes to really grow in our spiritual life, yeah, it's easy, you know, to be with people just so nice and easy. But really, are you learning very much from that? It's so easy to go to school and have a teacher who lets you do whatever you want and never sort of pushes you. But do you really learn from that? No, we learn from the irritating parts of life. That's where we really grow from. So number one, irritation is part of life. So instead of having this attitude, this is terrible, I'm going to get rid of it. No, embrace and exploit the irritations of life. And the story which comes to my mind about this was, again, my training in a traditional Buddhist monastery in the northeast of Thailand. Now, the other monks, they weren't so irritating. They were a nice group of people. We got on well together. But the most irritating thing in that monastery at that time, 36 years ago, was mosquitoes. Now, this is no joke. Those mosquitoes were actually quite large. Now, actually, much larger than I've seen in many other parts of Thailand. And number two, remember, this was 36 years ago in a jungles of Thailand, very backwards. There was no mosquito coils. There was no mosquito repellent. There was no mosquito screens. You just had to take it. And it was terrible because I was Western monk. Now remember this, mosquitoes, if they come and try and bite you, they're risking their life. Because, you know, most people, you swat them, you kill them. Now, maybe you may be a Buddhist, or maybe you may be vegetarian, maybe you have five precepts, maybe you wouldn't actually swat those mosquitoes, but they don't know that. You haven't got "I am a Buddhist" tattooed on your head. So they can't tell, but they see me. Brown robe, bald head. That means safe dinner. And remember, these are mosquitoes who've been bred in that country for, I don't know, they've been Buddhists over 1,000 years. So it's been genetically bred, you know, conditioned, you know, evolved. Those mosquitoes, they see a brown robe and they know safe dinner. So, of course, they'd leave you guys alone. They'd come to us. Just like, you know, the moths are attracted to light, mosquitoes are attracted to brown robes in Asia. Number two. You can see just the way we dress. Bare shoulders, bald heads. We've got more seats at the dinner table. And thirdly, I'm Western monk. And I was one of the first Western monks in this area. I remember one village I went to, I was not just first Western monk, I was the first white man who went into this village in northeast Thailand. They'd never seen a white man before, ever. I went to some remote places, and there you're a white monk. And they were supposed, you know, we went in there for alms round, you know, where they put food in the bowl for the monks. And that's all I would eat that day, whatever got into my bowl. And it was very, very disappointing because they were trying to put food in my bowl, but then instead they were looking at me and the food was dropping outside. Oh, that was really tough. Because, of course, you know, it was strange. But for the mosquitoes, this was the first time they had Western food. You know what it's like when a new cuisine comes to town? Everybody wants to try it out. So those mosquitoes were coming to the Western monks. The Thais, they were leaving. Look, you know, we get hundreds of them on our bodies. I'm not joking. You used to count them, 60 or 70 at a time. You look at the Thai monks, they were getting nothing at all, no mosquitoes on them. It was really unfair. And why was that? yeah, they'd had Thai food, and that's just ordinary Western food. You know, that's just a delicacy. So hold all these mosquitoes on you. And you just really wanted to swat them. You know what it's like. Is anybody watching? No, you just can't do it because it makes a noise. So it was terrible. You just had to endure and endure and endure. It got so bad for all of us that, you know, one day we went up to see our master, Ajahn Chah, the great compassionate one. Yeah, compassionate. He was really compassionate, but in this really weird way. Not the way we wanted him to be compassionate. Because we asked him, can we get some mosquito repellent or some coils which you can actually, you know, burn to keep the mosquitoes away, or some incense or something? He said, no. And he said, from now on, you must call those mosquitoes your guru, your teacher. That's what Ajahn means. Ajahn means teacher. So from that time on, they became Ajahn Mosquito. That was my teacher from now on. It was a very tough teacher, but you did learn a lot from Ajahn Mosquito. You know, actually, this is no joke. You know what I learned from that? I really learned how to meditate from Ajahn Mosquito, because so many were on your arms and on your head, and it was really, really irritating. So when I was meditating, the only thing I really had to go deep inside. Because if my mind wandered or started thinking, I wouldn't be thinking about lunch or dinner or sort of TV or anything. As soon as the mind wandered, it goes straight onto the arm or the head, which is so irritating. So it meant that when I watched my breath, I really watched my breath, and it wouldn't wander anywhere else. And I got some really great meditation from Ajahn Mosquito. In fact, it worked so well, I was wondering whether we can actually get a bottle and close the doors and have them in here or something to get people meditating. No, we can't do that. We get busted by the law or something. But anyway, because it was so irritating, it really made me sort of focus. Because otherwise, it was just unendurable. I've got some great meditations. But the weird thing about that was that when I got these nice meditations, and I came out afterwards, usually when you're bitten by mosquitoes, as a Westerner especially, you get little bumps, you know, little welts on your arm and on your head afterwards. But when I came out of meditation, there was no welts at all, no bumps. It was quite clear to me that no mosquitoes had bitten me for a long time. And I thought that was like, you know, one of the powers of meditation. You know, you get into deep meditation. It was deep meditation, really nice and blissful. You couldn't feel your body at all. And I thought that maybe get some force field around you so mosquitoes can't penetrate. But actually, only later on, when I came over here to Australia, maybe about 10 years ago, I read this article. They figured out mosquitoes, what they're attracted to is the carbon dioxide coming from your pores. And so when you really relax and become very still, like I was meditating, my metabolism went way down until, you know, because you were so still and so peaceful, you know, you weren't actually metabolizing very much at all. So hardly any carbon dioxide was coming out of my pores. And that was what made me invisible to the mosquitoes. So actually, the more you worry, the more tense you get, the more anxiety you have, the higher metabolism. And it's like a big neon sign, mosquitoes, I'm over here, come. But when you really relax and let go and be still, you just become invisible to mosquitoes. So actually, Ajahn Mosquito did teach me a lot. And it also taught me just about what irritation really is. I mean, the mosquitoes, they don't kill you. Yeah, you may have 100 on them and they're all slurping your blood, but there's still plenty left, after they've gone. It's only a little itch. And they're not going to give you dengue fever or malaria or something else. The chances of getting that are just so small, you've got more chance of getting hit by a truck. So because of that, I realized it was the fear and worry. That was the real problem. That was the real irritation. The actual being bitten by mosquitoes, that wasn't really much at all. It was the thought which comes afterwards. Why are they doing this to me? I don't want to do this. Are there going to be any more? Because you know some of those mosquitoes in Asia, in Australia too, you know, they know how to torture you. Because what they do, before they bite, they just go in your ear, first of all, bzz, 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 I'm coming, bzz, 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 bzz. And sometimes they think, why don't they just bite you and get it over and done with? But no, they go, I'm coming, that's called torture. But anyway, I think you know what I mean. But the main thing was the thinking about it. That was the problem with the irritation. And so you learn from Ajahn Mosquito not to think about things. So you may have a partner who's very irritating. Stop thinking about it. Because you know what it's like sometimes? They're not even in the room, and you're thinking about them. Or they've been in the room, and they left them maybe an hour ago, and they're still irritating you. Now, isn't that a bit crazy? So if they're not there, why do you allow yourself to be irritated by them? It's the way we think about it. We're afraid of it. That is the real problem. Now, I wrote this little story in Opening the Door of Your Heart. It just comes to my mind now. Over in Serpentine, many years ago, I was just walking to the workshop, you know, just to get some tool or other, and I saw one of the Anagarikas. These are the laymen who trained to be monks. And he was an old guy, and he was walking in the opposite direction, and he had a pair of pliers in his hand. And he had something bloody in the middle of the pair of pliers, and I looked at it, and it was a tooth. I said, "What's that?" He said, "I just took one of my teeth out." And I thought, "What have you been doing?" I said, "It's much cheaper than going to a dentist, and it doesn't hurt as much." So, "What do you mean?" "Because, you know, could you do that just with a pair of pliers from the workshop, you know, just get your teeth out?" Now, that's really something. But I asked him, "How did you do that?" And the explanation he gave was brilliant. And it fits into my talk now about irritation or pain. Because he said, "When I decided to take my own tooth out, that didn't hurt. When I walked to the tool shed, that didn't hurt. When I picked up the pliers, that didn't hurt either. When I put the pliers on the tooth, that didn't hurt. When I moved it backwards and forwards to pull it out, that hurt for about maybe 3 seconds. And afterwards, it didn't hurt." Now for you, even before you even picked up the pliers, that would hurt like hell. Even just thinking about someone else doing it hurts. Do you understand what I mean? That's a wonderful story just about what pain really is. 2 or 3 seconds and it's over. That's not much. But you can't do that simply because you think about it. This is going to hurt. This is terrible. I can't do this. I can't stand this. It's the thinking about it is the most painful and the difficult. And the same with irritation. It's the thinking about it, the worrying about it, the brooding on it. That is a real problem. And of course, that is something you can do something about. So they're not in the room, or you're not in the room with that irritating person. So what are you worried about? Enjoy it when they're not there. Have some fun. But a lot of times, the trouble with us, we're so much worried about the future. We cling so much to the past. They've just irritated us once, and we dwell upon it for days afterwards. We allow them to torture us and torture us and torture us. So, at least be wise enough to never allow anyone to control your happiness in such a way. Yeah, when they're right in front of you, they irritate you. Fair enough. But they only irritate me for a moment, at most. And then they go. And so does the irritation go. You develop what we call in Buddhism the Teflon mind, when nothing sticks to it. Or, the other simile is, when people irritate you, we'll call this in Australian, in English language, they dump on you. And when they dump on you, you're compassionate. You have to accept it. Like everybody dumps on me just before I come in here when I'm sitting out there on the seat. And I sit up here after the talk and they dump on me again. Oh, they dump, 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 dump. But that's my job. I'm going on an aircraft tomorrow. I don't know who's going to sit next to me, but they'll probably dump on me again. I'm going to spend a whole week in Indonesia and they're going to dump, dump, dump. But that's what happens in life, isn't it? That's being a friend, being a compassionate person. But as Ajahn Chah, this great wise teacher, said, in a way which I'd always remember, because it was a simile, it was funny. And when we give talks here, one of the reasons I think many of you come here is because it's not theory. Actually, it's theory, but it's practical and said in a way that you always remember. And he said, when people dump on you, Ajahn Brahm, you must think of yourself like a dustbin, like a trash can. And you must allow people to put all their rubbish into you. Look, people tell me about their marriage problems. I became a monk to get away from that. And now what happens? You know, Dennis was saying about, you know, making Hello Magazine. That's Hello Magazine Asian edition. Because I did a celebrity marriage over there. So I can't even escape. They make me sort of do the marriages with Dennis. But anyway, I don't mind. I enjoy this stuff. It's good fun. But what happens is, he said, you have to be a rubbish bin, a trash can. But the most important thing when you are a trash can is be a trash can, a rubbish bin, with a hole in the bottom. That's the most important. So you accept all the rubbish, but you keep nothing. It just goes right out afterwards. Like be a rubbish bin with a hole in the bottom, which means you're always empty for the next person who comes in here and dumps some more rubbish inside of you. Because that's really important, isn't it? Look, if you're going to be a compassionate, kind person, I mean, people do have their problems. I know a lot of times, you know, they don't want answers to their problems. They just want someone to hear them and just to unload on them. That's all they really need. So they want to bung stuff inside of you. But how many of you keep it? And so the next person comes up. You've had enough. Sorry, go away. I've had it up to here with other people's problems. That means you haven't got a hole in the bottom. You keep things. Or irritating things. People are dumping on you, and it gets so high. That's the problem. You just can't take any more because you haven't let go of the old stuff. You haven't had a hole in the bottom. So the next thing with learning to deal with irritating people is imagine yourself to be the dustbin, the trash can, with this wonderful big hole in the bottom. So all this irritating stuff, it just goes right through you. You don't keep a thing. You're Teflon. Nothing sticks. But you can actually divide. You know, you have these two rubbish bins these days, the yellow bins for recycled stuff and the other stuff, you know, the rubbish, real rubbish stuff, the household rubbish. You also divide the things which happen in your life as well for the irritating stuff. And the beautiful stuff. And the recycling stuff, what do you mean by recycling? You keep using it. You keep the recyclable stuff. All the times people say, you're just a wonderful person. Every time they say, oh, so thank you very much for being who you are. That stuff, recycle that again and again and again and again. That should go in the yellow bin in your head. And keep it. Recycle it. But the rubbish stuff, right down the bottom, and that gets picked up. In my monastery, every Friday. I don't know whether it gets picked up for you. But you don't keep it, okay? So then the irritating stuff, it doesn't build up to the point where you're really having a big problem. So, yeah, your partner can say this. Yeah, your partner can say that. You don't keep it. But then you will actually find sometimes your partner says some nice things to you. There's nobody that irritating that they always, every moment of the day, give you a hard time. They've always got their nice side, their beautiful side. So remember keeping that. And then your whole attitude to that person starts to change. And you realize, actually, they're not just the irritating person. There's actually got another side to them. And something important happens now. Because it is a truth. I've seen this in my life. What you see in other people is what they show you back. What you look for is what they present to you. So if you've got the idea that your partner is just so irritating, why did I hook up with that guy, that girl? I must have been drunk when I sort of asked her out. I must have been out of my mind. I must have been whatever it was. Don't even think like that, because once you start thinking like that, if you're looking, now, through those negative lenses, that's all you'll see in that person. They'll show you what you're looking for. So part of the training in Buddhism, the training of the mind, is train yourself to look for the positive in other people. Oh, my goodness, that's what they show you. And I've challenged people for years on, you know, having someone who's really irritating, really tough, really sort of a bad person, and seeing if you can change them. And one of the classic stories was years ago when I was teaching up at Karna Prison Farm. And I had a little meditation group up there, and one day I was talking like this, and you know what people say. You know, they say, you know, they're very sort of skeptical about all this, you know, new age, positive thinking stuff. They say, yeah. You know, we like you, Ajahn Brahm, but, you know, this is the real world. This is actually worse than the real world, in a prison. People are rough, they're tough, they're mean in here. So you just can't do that. You can't look for the nice things in other people. If you look for the nice things, you'll find a fist in your face or something worse. And so I was a scientist. I still am a scientist. I love science. Experiments. Let's do an experiment. So I asked this group of prisoners, who's the really worst person you know? Who's the person who irritates you the most? The first person you get sprayed if the pest controller actually came. Who would you really love to get rid of? And straight away they said, actually one of the prison officers. And he said, this guy is a dog, a real bad case. And they gave me an example just the previous week. What had happened, I remember this story, what had happened is one of the prisoners in that jail, which is, you know, just past our monastery, it's quite remote, the wife had managed to get a lift to go for a visit. And it was the first time she managed to get a lift for a couple of months. And this prison officers saw this woman, you know, check in for a visit and go through the security screening. And he knew who it was. So he used his authority to send this prisoner on an errand to the other side of the prison. This is a prison farm. Much of that place, you just, you know, the PA system doesn't reach. So he sent him on an errand to the far field. And of course, as soon as his wife had checked in, they put an announcement out, would prisoner so-and-so please come to the visitor's area? You have a visit. No one could find him. Prison officer knew where he was. They repeated the announcement, then they sent someone to find him. And by the time they found him and brought him to the visitor's area, visiting time was over. Sorry, better not next time. And this was like a visit, maybe for the first time in a couple of months, for this prisoner from his wife. And this prison officer did this just out of badness, ill will. Just a really rotten thing to do. He said that was typical of this prison officer. Not all prison officers are like that. They're really some really nice people. Actually, a lot of them are very nice people, but this was one of the bad ones. So I said, great, we have a contest. So I said, who knows, who has anything to do with this prison officer? And one of the prisoners in my group, you know, he was one of these fraudsters, you know, who just, you know, cooked the books or something. And, you know, because he was respected, he had a nice job of serving the tea and coffee, you know, to the people in the administrative wing. And this prison officer worked there. So I said, great. What I want you to do, I said, is every time you make a cup of tea or make a cup of coffee for this dog, I mean prison officer, make something nice. Put some love into that teapot. You know, put some, you know, extra bit of coffee, you know, extra hot water, whatever it is. Really put some care and love into what you're doing. And when you present that cup of coffee to that prison officer, do it with love and kindness. Say, here you are, sir. I hope you enjoy it. Or say something nice. And to that prisoner's credit, he said, I would do that. And so we had a test. But every week I used to go there. I said, how's it going? He said, totally waste of time. He said, sometimes I really put a lot of effort. I try my best to make a nice cup of coffee. Try and find out what he likes. And I give it to him and say, here you are, sir. Have a nice cup of coffee. And he totally ignores me. I just don't exist. I'm just invisible to these guys. They don't even deign to turn around and look at me. I said, carry on. And of course, he had no choice. He was in there for quite a long time. Which is one of the advantages of doing these experiments in prison. So it took about 3 or 4 months. Actually, not that long, really. We got our first breakthrough, and I'll never forget this. He was so excited, waiting for me before the class began. He said, never guess what happened. So what happened? We got a breakthrough. What happened? He said, look, I made this cup of tea, and I got some special tea from somewhere, and I just made it just as he liked it, and I just gave it to him, and I presented it to him, and I said, special tea for you, sir. I'm sure you like this. I hope you enjoy it. And the prison officer said, He actually acknowledged I exist. He grunted. And that was the breakthrough. It really was, because it only took about another month later. And he had a big smile. He said, you won. He said, because they gave him a cup of coffee. They managed to get some biscuits or somewhere from somewhere. It's amazing just how resourceful those prisoners can be inside jail. You know, I'm not supposed to have anything there, but amazing what they can find. But anyway, they had a biscuit. Said, here you are, sir. It's a special biscuit. I hope you enjoy it. And the prison officer turned around to this prisoner and said, thank you. And I remember that moment as well, even though it was many years ago. The prisoner said, you wouldn't believe that thank you went right around the prison system in Western Australia. There's a grapevine there. And he said they could not believe that that prison officer said thank you to a prisoner. You won, Ajahn Brahm. Or at least, no, like loving kindness or care won. It was a tough case, but it works. So, your irritating partner. It may take 3 or 4 months until you get the first grunt. But it does work. And it's a beautiful way of saying, yes, it can be done. But if you keep looking for the irritation, of course, it will just keep on coming up. And if you keep giving irritation back, because they're irritating you and you irritate them back, of course, it's going to get worse. So don't look for the irritation. Look for the other part of them. Don't look for the 2 bad bricks in the wall. Look for the 998 good bricks. And if you don't know that story by now, I'm giving up, because I said that so many times. It's in the book anyway. You can read it, get it on the website or whatever. But this is the way we deal with the irritations in life. We don't just focus on them. We focus on the other part of them. And you can change the people you live with. I know that people say in marriage counseling, no, you just, I know women want to change their husband and they can't. And the husbands don't want to change their wife and they always get older and droopier. But, you know, that's just nature. But, you know, we don't. But the thing is, you can change this character anyway, just by the way we relate to these things. And that is actually where the solution lies. And of course, the way we change the people is, it's a relationship. And that celebrity wedding I did, in the article they said afterwards, one of the things they really got when I gave the wedding sort of piece of advice to this couple was, again, that sort of story about, it's never, once you're married, it's never about me anymore. It's never about my partner anymore. It's about us. Because she recognized that, you know, before they were married, it was always she was blaming him. It's your fault. You know, it's, you know, you should change or you should do something. They can see what the problem is there. You should change. You're not taking any part in the solution. You're giving the whole problem to the other person, and they have to fix it. And in any troubles in life, that will never work, wherever that is, in whatever situation. It is never someone else's problem. Even worse, when you think it's my problem, there's something wrong with me. Why do I have a partner like that? I must have been stupid. That's like as if it's you're taking the problem on yourself. It's never my problem. It's never their problem. Whose problem is it? Our problem. So it's amazing just what happens when you change that perception. And it's our problem, and it's a relationship problem. You don't fix that person. You don't fix yourself. You fix the way you deal with that other person. You fix the way you deal with life. You fix the way that you relate to irritations. Number one, accept them. Number two, exploit them. Give them kindness. And you find the irritations, actually, they fade away. They are adjuncts. They are teachers. They are teaching you about what life is. Sooner or later, you'll have the biggest irritation in your life. When you get old and sick and die and end up in a nursing home or in an old people's home or a sort of a cemetery. And that's very irritating, dying. But how can we actually deal with that? Again, it's just not dying or old age. It's the way we deal with it, our relation to that. That is the problem. It's not my problem. It's not old age problem. It's not my problem. It's not death problem. It's not my problem. It's sickness problem. It's how you relate to these things. And that's such a beautiful opportunity, because if it was like, you know, old age and sickness and death, if that was a problem, it would just be insoluble. You just have to just bite your lip and take the pain and suffering of life. There'd be no release from life. And if it was, you know, the fact that, you know, you can't find a perfect partner in life, well, that would just be impossible, because where on earth are you going to find a perfect partner in life? There's actually an old story about that. Maybe I haven't told this for about 3 months. There's a person over in sort of Australia, over in Sydney. And this guy, he was, you know, very, very wealthy. He inherited a lot of money from his grandfather. And he was about 6'3", blue-eyed, really strong, great pecs. He was actually drop-dead gorgeous. And he thought, you know, he had a double first from Cambridge. And he thought, look, so what a great guy I am. I'm absolutely perfect. Rich, good-looking, well-educated, cultured. He said, I'm so perfect. Now, I'm going to choose the most perfect girl in the world, you know, to marry. And I'm not going to choose a settle for second best. She has to be really perfect. So he went over to Sydney and found this really, really gorgeous girl. Now, the sort of girl you see in the front cover of magazines. And the... went out with her for a while, but just she wasn't perfect enough for him. He found out she couldn't cook. She was hopeless. And so he said, no, I want someone who's beautiful and can cook. So he went down to Melbourne, and he met this girl. She was even more beautiful than the girl in Sydney. And this girl owned her own restaurant. She was a perfect cook. So he thought, wow, this is perfect girl for me. But after going out with her for a few weeks, no, he dumped her too, because she was stupid. he had a double first from Oxford. He tried to relate to her, and she didn't know anything. So she wasn't perfect enough. And so where did he come next? To Perth. And there he found the most beautiful girl in the whole world. Oh, she was really, really gorgeous. She was like heavenly, she's like an angel. And she owned 5 restaurants. And her cooking just would just make sort of all these celebrity chefs drool. They were nowhere near as good as this cook. And she was so intelligent. She had a double first, not only from Cambridge, but from Harvard and Oxford and Yale and everywhere, and from UWA. She was so intelligent. She was the most perfect girl. But he couldn't marry her either. You know why? Because she was looking for the perfect guy. And that, I love that story when I first read it, because sometimes isn't that what you want in life? You're looking for the perfect guy, but you never find one because you're not the perfect girl. The answer to that story, just, you know, cut your losses. You're not perfect. Your partner's not perfect, so be happy you found someone who can pull up with you. So that way, we sort of don't have so much expectation. So when we are irritated by someone, yeah, we irritate them back. So, you know, just fair's fair. Anyway, we all know the law of karma anyway. You all get what you deserve in life. That's what the law of karma means. You get what we deserve. We earned it. Anyway, so if you have got someone who's not perfect, don't get irritated by it. Just accept it. Now, that is one of the reasons why love is most important. You can't love someone if they're perfect. It's just too easy. There's no challenge there. I mean, what is love about anyway? I think I said a few weeks ago. Now, I go traveling a lot. And the one time I really see babies and when they really play up is on the aircraft. You know, in economy class, they're there. And as soon as the plane takes off, rah, rah, rah. And, you know, it's in a sort of a confined space, you know, in the economy class cabin. That really resonates. And to this day, I just really admire those mothers who just look after that kid throughout the whole flight. And you know, I'm a monk, I'm compassionate, I can endure hundreds of mosquitoes, but that, I admit, that's too much for me. So how can you do that? It's because there's a certain amount of love which doesn't see irritation anymore and can actually endure and love and care even though it's so irritating. If you can do that to a little baby, why can't you do that to a big baby called your husband? Why can't I do that to your little wife, the big girl rather than the big baby daughter? So we can do that if we really want to. It's possible. What that told me and taught me, it is actually possible to love what is naturally irritating. So how do we do that? Because we see a bigger picture there. That's how we do that. Instead of just seeing that one little thing which you don't like, see the bigger picture. And that's somebody actually we can train with, an ajahn, a teacher, which shows us, yeah, it's when we hate that irritating behavior, when we reject it, when we don't know how to make use of it, that is when we add the pain onto the irritation and the rejection. And that makes the other person even more irritated. So instead of doing that, we see that irritation. This is, I am reacting in a dysfunctional manner to whatever this person is saying or doing or screaming. It doesn't help the baby to throttle them. It doesn't help your partner to give as good as you get. There's another way. And that other way, again, is a lot of times is ignoring the irritation. And putting positive reinforcing, encouraging the other part of the behavior. I don't know when the last time I said the story of that woman I read in a psychology magazine who was doing a PhD in psychology, and her subject was how they train dolphins in these marine parks, you know, to play water polo, to jump through these hoops. And she found out that the way they do this is if that dolphin jumps an inch higher, you throw the dolphin a fish. Positive reinforcement. If it doesn't jump, you don't hit it, you don't get angry at the dolphin. You just wait until it jumps 2 inches and then it gets another fish. So every time it gets incrementally closer to what you want that dolphin to do, that's when you throw another fish to the dolphin. Incremental positive reinforcement. Now this woman, I really kicked myself for not keeping that article because this was one wise woman. She went to her supervisor at university and got permission to change her thesis. Because she realized, she had this wonderful insight, the very same technique which they used to teach dolphins at these marine parks could be used on her husband. So she got permission from her supervisor to change the thesis, instead of how to train dolphins, how to train husbands. It's a brilliant piece of advice. And it's practical too. How do you do this? It works the same as how you train wives, or how do you train girlfriends or partners or people in your office. Whenever they do something wrong and they irritate you, ignore it. Don't do anything. But when they do something you like which is not irritating, that's when you throw them a fish. Metaphorically, that is. In other words, you give them some sort of positive feedback. And of course, that actually works. And in her article, the one part I remember, she said one of the most irritating parts of her relationship with her husband, and many of you may be able to relate to this, in the morning when they were both getting ready to go to work, he could never find his tie. And wife was trying to get ready to go to work too, and she has to dress up much more than a guy does. And she, darling, have you seen my tie? Can you help me find my tie? It's only a small thing like that, but that every morning that really irritates you. You're trying to get ready, and here's this stupid guy, and he can't even remember where he put his own clothes. And she would always get very angry and irritated at him for this. And so she tried the throwing the fish method. So when he couldn't find his tie, "Where's my tie, darling? Can you help me find my tie?" He would ignore it. She would ignore it. She wouldn't get irritated. She wouldn't complain. She would just totally ignore it and go around her task. And of course, eventually he'd find his tie himself. And that's when she would stop what she was doing and give him a big hug and kiss. "Oh, well done, darling." That was throwing the fish. And you may laugh, but this was very, very effective. In a couple of months, she said, "He never asks me now. He just finds his own stuff. And now I'm free in the morning to do what I like to do instead of helping this guy." There's one example amongst many of how to train people. Positive reinforcement. Basic Buddhist psychology. You don't need to get irritated. Being irritated is being stupid. Be smart. So don't give way to that irritation. Get upset. Just be peaceful with it. Don't think about it. Don't keep it. Be the dustbin. At the same time, do something, a strategy, a positive thing. When you can start doing that to your husband, to your wife, to your kids, to your mother-in-law or whatever. Actually, there was a joke about that mother-in-law I read this afternoon, about mother-in-law was coming over for dinner. And so she asked her grandson, "So what are we having for dinner?" Her grandson said, "We're having goat for dinner." "Goat for dinner?" said the mother-in-law. "Yeah, I just overheard my father talking to my uncle on the phone. We're having the old goat for dinner." Anyway, it's well, you haven't heard it before. That's the only good thing about that joke. Instead of getting irritated at these things, we just start taking it in our stride. Because a lot of times we get irritated because we're getting angry at things which we, at that moment, we can't change. There it is. And so why do we add to the suffering of our life? Now, life is like this. I don't know, tomorrow morning I'll go to the airport. Maybe my aircraft is cancelled. I don't get irritated if the flight is delayed or cancelled, because I've noticed the more you get irritated, it doesn't make that plane come faster. The more you get irritated at your husband or your wife, it doesn't make them any better, does it? You tried that for a long time. So try another way. Don't get irritated when they get irritable at you. Just let that go and just throw them a fish at the right time, but not when they're getting irritated, when they do something nice to you. And that way we're learning a lot about life. We're learning not just about how to live with other people, we're also learning how to live with life itself, because life is sometimes very irritating. It's too hot, it's too cold, it's not raining enough. We're still okay down at our monastery down at Serpentine, but our dams have never been that low before. And one thing I'd really ask you, when you go down to there, please avoid the kangaroos, because they really smell now, because the only time they have a bath is when it rains, and it hasn't rained for a long time now. So we're very, very dry down there. But we don't get irritated at that. It's just like, when it gets too hot, we had that really hot spell a few weeks ago. It was just really hot for a long, long period of time. It's pretty warm this evening. So do you get irritated when it gets hot? Stupid. It's not, it's not the weatherman's fault. Actually, people actually do that. They do actually call up the weather bureau, the meteorological office, and complain. Come on, you're in charge of the weather. Make it go cold or make it rain. So instead of that, I advise Buddhist climate control. You know what Buddhist climate control is? I said this on a sort of Saturday afternoon to people. When it's hot, keep a cool head. When it's cold, keep a warm heart. That's called Buddhist climate control. At least because, this is part of life. It's going to be like this. And so instead of getting angry, if you're getting angry when it's hot, does it get cooler? It gets hotter, doesn't it? When it's really cold, you start to complain, it feels more cold. So that's why a warm heart means we can open the door of our heart to whatever happens in life. If it's too hot, we keep a cool head. We don't think about it, worry about it. That's the same with the irritations of life. So when irritations of life come, just keep cool with it. Don't add to it. This is so much in life, our irritation. We don't want to add to it and be irritated to irritate. at irritability. We've got this concept in Buddhism, like suffering. We call it dukkha. Many of you have heard that word before. Dukkha means suffering. We've also got in Buddhism what we call double dukkha, double suffering. Double suffering doesn't sound as nice as double dukkha. That's why I love, you know, introducing some Buddhist words. You know, the word karma is, you know, everyone knows the word karma now, maybe nirvana, these Buddhist words. Dukkha is the word for suffering, and double dukkha is double suffering. What is double suffering? Double suffering is when it's hot. It's, I don't want it to be hot. It shouldn't be hot. I don't like it when it's hot. That's adding this reaction to life. Somebody says, you know, you're stupid, you're an idiot, Ajahn Brahm. You tell the worst jokes in the whole world, Ajahn Brahm. And I get, oh, why do they say that? I'll try my very best. And that's called double dukkha, when you get angry at what other people are saying to you. So we have a certain amount of suffering in life, the irritating wife, the irritating mother-in-law, the irritating government, the irritating whatever else is irritating you. That is life, okay? That's single dukkha. By saying, I don't want this, I don't like this, it shouldn't be that way, that's called double dukkha. And that double dukkha is the worst. At least I only have single dukkha. Some people have treble dukkha, quadruple dukkha, multiple dukkha. That's because they get really so screwed up. I don't like this, and I don't like to be like this, and I don't like to be angry like this, or whatever. So don't get irritated at yourself either. Are you irritated at yourself? I'm hopeless, I'm stupid, I shouldn't have done this, I made a mistake, I messed up, I fouled up. No, be like the dustbin. Whatever you do, just let it go straight through you in life. So you're always open for the next experience in life. Because if you keep all the pain in your life and feel so negative, your dustbin is too big. It's full. Sorry, it's too stuffed up. So you can never experience anything beautiful in life. So let all that past go. Be empty. So you can always be free for the next thing which is happening. But being irritated, allowing yourself to be irritated at life, is just keeping more rubbish in your bin. So nothing else can ever go in. Your stuff. You can never be open and enjoy new things in life, whatever happens. So when you learn to let go of the irritations of life, yeah, sometimes life is irritable. But then it just goes immediately. In the next moment, who knows what happiness, what joy, what interesting things will happen next. And certainly that's happened to me whenever things have gone wrong in my life. Yeah, things have gone wrong, but we haven't sort of lingered on them, and something nice has happened next. Because I haven't been angry and irritated, those beautiful things happen very, very quickly. So that's the nature of our life. So please, irritability, learning to deal with the irritations of life, these are your teachers. Learn to just to be a dustbin and just let them go right through. Don't keep anything. And also to learn just that you can change things by being kind and caring. And it's just the positive reinforcement, throwing people a fish, throw yourself a fish. If you've done a really good thing, please praise yourself and give yourself an extra bit of chocolate cake or whatever else you like. Forget about what it's doing to your body. What it's doing to your mind is more important. It is, because your body's, I mean, okay, it wears out and you get a new one in your next life, but your mind keeps going on. It's much better to look after your mind than look after your body, okay? Your body's transient thing. So look after your mind, it's more important, because that goes with you wherever you go. So that's why it doesn't mind, you know, just giving yourself a bit of a treat every now and again. Don't worry too much about these things anyway. Because of all, what kills most people is not the sort of the cholesterol or the diabetes, it's actually the worry about these things. That's what kills most people. It's true, that saying that George Burns, one of my heroes, the great comic, in 96th birthday, I remember this quote, I wrote it down, it was, I think, in Time magazine, they interviewed him, 96 years old, this American comedian. And he smoked cigars, not just ordinary cigarettes, you know, really sort of smoky cigars. He drank whiskey. He ate fatty foods, you know, KFC, I'm not supposed to say anything like this, all fatty foods, whatever. And he used to stay up late at night, 2 or 3 o'clock, going to nightclubs at 96. And so the reporter said, look at your lifestyle. Aren't you worried about your lifestyle, or the fatty food and alcohol and smoke, all the things which are bad for you? And his answer, I'll never forget his response, he said, I'm not worried about those things. My wife was worried about those things, and that's why she died 20 years ago. And it's true, you understand that. I mean, it's a worry about things. Okay, you know, eat healthy food and don't stay up late at night and stuff like that. Yeah, that's good for you, but the worry is the main thing. So don't worry. Don't get irritated. Don't get negative. You can have a happy life. And those people you live with, it's an irritating husband. If he's no much better Buddhist than you are, then be so thankful. You know, he's actually drawing you deeper into sort of learning. And I don't know what it is, but you know, you get a really good husband, you complain. You get a bad husband, you complain. He says, just Michael, you complain about everything. So don't complain, and just, you know, learn and allow life to be. And just again, it's not having a good husband or a bad husband, a good wife or a bad wife. It's not the person. It's not the ingredients of life. It's how you put them together. What you do with the person you are and the person you're with. That's actually where life lives, in the relationship you have. And it's to care and be positive with whatever you have to deal with in life. That's the key to happiness and peace. And that's the talk for this evening. So thank you, everybody, for listening once again. Okay, so now is the time to pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha, to do some bowing if you wish. And afterwards, you can have a cup of tea or come and ask questions.
Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadin Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassam Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sāṅgho Sāṅkhaṁ Namāmi.